at AOI. Your staff is distributing for you to you a copy of a report that we commissioned late last year on the capital gains issue by William Connolly, a well-known economic consultant, I think well-known to most, if not all of you, primarily due to his participation in the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors. And Bill produced this report in late January for us, and what I'm going to do today is to just step you through the report, some of the highlights of the report as background for our discussion of this bill. And I'd like to start out, if I might, by reiterating the quote of Alan Greenspan that Mr. Connolly included in his report. And Mr. Greenspan, in testimony before Congress on this issue, said its major impact is to impede entrepreneurial activity and capital formation. While all taxes impede economic growth to one extent or another, the capital gains tax is at the far end of the scale. I argued, he said, that the appropriate capital gains tax rate was zero. That quote's on page 17 of the report. I'll just go through some of the executive summary items, and then some of the dig a little bit deeper into the report on these items. Over half of all families own assets subject to the capital gains tax. And at some time during their life, about two-thirds of families will own such capital gains tax eligible or subject assets. Oregon's state capital gains tax rate is second highest in the country, exceeded only by California. And revenue from the source of revenue to the state's treasury is the most volatile major source of revenue. How are capital gains different? They're different primarily due to the effects of inflation on an investment over a period of time. There is no adjustment, as you know, for inflation in the capital gains taxation system. And when you combine corporate income tax in a corporate setting and capital gains, the capital gains tax takes away about 57% of an investor's pre-tax gain. The capital gains tax then significantly reduces capital spending. And the lock-in effect, I think you're familiar with, essentially where investors tend to hold on to assets for perhaps longer than they should due to the capital gains tax, and that is called the lock-in effect, that capital does not flow to its most economic advantageous application because of the effects of the capital gains tax. Well, what are the economic effects of the capital gains of a capital gains tax cut? Obviously, stimulation of investment and capital formation is top of the list. Cutting the state's capital gains tax rate to 4% could boost real per capita income by over 1% per year. A 1% to most people doesn't sound like very much, but when you're looking at per capita income growth, that is a tremendous boost to economic growth. Venture capital, the seed money, seed corn, if you will, for the entrepreneurial activities in this or any other state, Mr. Connolly estimates would be increased by from 13% to 17% after the cut that is proposed in this bill. The lower rate would increase asset values of Oregon small businesses, farms, and investment property by 4.5%. And help seniors reduce the risks of their retirement funds. We'll talk about that in a little more detail later. The revenue effects of a capital gains cut, as you know, a static model estimate of capital gains reduction is $217 million per year, average through 2007. An average isn't a word that you need to to think about because of the volatility of capital gains income to the state and to the taxpayers, as we'll see in the report. Varying estimates of offsetting impacts of economic activity generated by a reduction in the capital gains tax rate leave a range based on the economist that that is cited, and he cites four different scenarios, Mr. Connerly does, in this report, vary from a dynamic model revenue loss to the state treasury of $180 million per year to an actual revenue increase of $148 million per year. So there's a wide band for you to think about. Well, who would benefit from the capital gains tax cut? David Weiss from DRI, who is the state's consultant on economic forecasting, has been quoted as saying capital gains tax cut essentially helps most people and hurts no one. Workers would benefit from lower capital gains tax rates through stronger demand for labor, which will push up real wage rates. Senior citizens will benefit, as they now bear a disproportionate share of the capital gains tax burden, which we'll also see. By way of quick background, Oregon has tied to the federal code. As you know, Oregon is more reliant on a single source of revenue, the income tax, than any other state in the union. And we have fairly carefully and fairly consistently tied to the federal code. And in the 1986 Major Federal Tax Reform Act, engineered by Senator Packwood, as you know, the 60% exclusion, which was there to recognize the effects of inflation and the risks that investors bear, was eliminated. And so that in Oregon, at least, capital gains income was treated exactly the same for tax purposes under income tax code as wage income or other income. The federal government changed that their treatment of capital gains in 1997 with a reduction from 28% down to 20%. And since it wasn't technically a coordination of the two codes, it was a rate change at the federal level. Oregon has not modified its capital gains tax rate since that time. On page 7, and if you don't mind, if you'd like to follow along, I'll just point out the pages that I'm on. There are some graphs that I want to point out to you as we go along. On page 7, assets that generate capital gains. We probably think typically of stock ownership when we think about capital gains, but as you can see from the table on page 7, the substantial portion of net gains in real estate or other than a personal residence, small businesses, business property, and livestock, timber, and farmland. Those all added up are 41% of capital gains in Oregon, a rather substantial level. And again, you're all familiar, I think, that over half of families now in the U.S. and certainly in Oregon are subject to the capital gains tax. On page 8, Mr. Connerly notes that there is the life cycle effect when you're talking about capital gains, and that simply means that as people age and as they are able to accumulate more assets over their life, they become more subject to the capital gains tax as they grow older. And Mr. Connerly suggests on the bottom of page 8 that it's likely that two-thirds of all families, two-thirds, own capital gains assets at some time in their lives. So that 50% becomes a much higher number when you look at the life cycle effect as it affects capital gains. As I mentioned earlier, Oregon now has the number two highest capital gains tax rate in the United States, and that graph on page 10 depicts that rather dramatically. Of course, the states with no income tax, like our neighbor to the north, Washington, it presents Oregon with a rather sharp contrast in tax structures, as you know. So we face a 9% on the sale of an asset, on the gain of sale of an asset in Oregon, versus zero right across the river in Washington State. And the table on page 11, just to give you some range of tax burdens on capital gains, not only in the United States, where Oregon there has a 29%, coupling the two, the federal and the state tax rates together, comparing them with some other countries. And you can see at the bottom those countries with zero rate of tax on capital gains, and many others with a lesser rate than Oregon. Volatility. We talked a little bit about volatility on page 12. You can see the volatility in the Oregon capital gains on the top of page 12. Huge spikes and then declines to below the zero line in some of those years. The latest one that we've had in Oregon was 1994, when it went below zero. We had negative capital gains income in that year. And some other years as high as 80%, for example, in the mid-80s. That is extreme volatility, very difficult for the state to predict what its revenue might be from this particular source of income. And nationally, you can see the graph at the bottom of page 12. Another way that Mr. Connerly has depicted Oregon's reliance, if you will, on capital gains is on page 13, second only behind Colorado. And because of its volatility, that gives us some instability in our tax and our revenue system because of that heavy reliance on capital gains. Inflation. On page 14, Bill's report talks about the effects of inflation. And he takes you through an example where the adjusting for inflation, the effective tax rate of capital gains is not 29% on this hypothetical 9% return, but is actually 44% measured against the real return after inflation, a rather hefty tax exaction, I think you'll agree, from a source of revenue that really drives this country and Oregon's economy as well. On page 16, Mr. Connerly's report takes you through the analysis arriving at the corporate example where the effective tax rate is 57% after you pay Oregon and federal corporate income tax, and then federal and state capital gains tax rates upon sale of a share of stock in this hypothetical example. And there on page 17, you'll see Mr. Greenspan's quote. But the effects on investment and capital are summarized in this report. The capital gains tax raises the cost of capital to businesses. It reduces the cash available to people to fund new investments. And it's especially important in influencing venture capital, as I mentioned a few minutes ago. Also, part of the burden of this tax, as I mentioned, is lower wages for workers because it reduces investment spending, the high rate of capital gains. Venture capital, let's talk about that for just a moment on page 20. The graph at the top of page 20 demonstrates the generation of venture capital relative to the maximum federal rate of tax on capital gains. And I think you can see the rather startling impacts of a major reduction in the federal capital gains tax rate in the late 1970s, early 1980s, and going along at a fairly steady state since that time, and the rapid increase in the generation of venture capital. Again, the estimate of 13 to 17% increase that would result if we were to reduce our rate of capital gains tax from 9% to 4%. And then he, Bill discovered, I think, perhaps something that you would know if you thought about it, but I hadn't thought a whole lot about it, and that is the impacts of the capital gains, which is particularly heavy on senior citizens. Self-sufficiency in retirement is the title he gives to this portion of his report. And he gives a hypothetical example. Because of the tendency to not sell assets that are not tax protected in a federal account of some kind, retirement account, is to hold on to those assets. And when you do so, your successful stocks, for example, become a too large a share of your retirement assets, thus making that portfolio more risky. So seniors tend to end up with more risky portfolios than they otherwise would because of the effects of capital gains taxes. And seniors certainly hold a larger share of capital gains assets than any other segment of our society. On page 24, Mr. Connerly states that the capital gains tax, cutting the capital gains tax rate increases investment spending, raises labor productivity, raises demand for labor, and raises wages. And again, the quotation from Mr. Wise of DRI, capital gains cut helps most people and hurts no one. Over on page 27, where we're talking about asset values, and I mentioned this earlier in the summary, that the market value of Oregon's small businesses, farms, and investment property would be increased by 4.5% after the capital gains tax rate cut of the magnitude that would be implemented with Senate Bill 67. On page 28, the listing of benefits, I think, are noted there for you. The static revenue effect is to reduce revenues in proportion to the cut, but the turnover of assets increases collections tax revenue with an especially large effect in the first year. And I think your staff has some data on that. We'll verify that. Assets are valued more highly because of the lower capital gains tax rate, raising asset prices and thus tax revenues. And there is some income reclassification as taxpayers put more effort into shifting regular income into capital gains. The economy grows at a faster rate, which further increases tax revenues. And Mr. Connerly states that to that list, he would add retention of taxpayers within the state of Oregon. This is the cross-border effect of these dramatically different tax systems between Washington, where there is no income tax at all, including capital gains, and Oregon, with a capital gains rate of 9%, and with a willingness to physically move your residence, legal residence, across the river. You can sell a business and avoid that heavy tax burden. And he talks a little bit more about the taxpayer retention issue on page 31. Let's talk for just a minute about the rather widely varying revenue impact estimates on page 32 and 33. I think probably the graph on page 33 shows it best, with a static estimate of revenue loss being the yellow line at the bottom, which shows a decline there in that range of $200 million a year and flatlining basically out. And then three scenarios, which are based on economic analysis by various economists, with a conservative, a competitive, and optimistic projections of what might happen with a capital gains tax cut. And he says that the bottom line is that there will probably, but not certainly, be some cost to the state's revenues from such a tax cut, but that is the price to be paid for the benefits described earlier. I guess that's the sort of the easy way out, is to give you a broad range and say that it could go from a very optimistic model to generating additional revenue for the state treasury to one that is modestly less than the static model. And I think that your staff has now the capability to run the numbers and give you some kind of a feel for what the revenue impacts would be under a more dynamic estimate rather than the static basis that has always had to work with in past years. On page 34, Mr. Connerly makes the point in an example of a beauty salon owner that if you don't look under the numbers, it's easy to assume that capital gains is really only a benefit, lower capital gains taxes are really only a benefit for the rich. And the example he uses is someone who has started a business, and as you know, Oregon is one of the, if not the most dependent on small business states in the union. We seem to be a state that attracts people who want to be independent and run their own business. So we have a large number of these small businesses. And he uses an example of a beauty salon owner who works for a number of years, ultimately purchases the building in which her business resides, but never over the years has earned much more than average income. He uses a number of $40,000 per year. But upon retirement, there's a one-time sale of that asset. And it throws that taxpayer into a bracket that looks like anybody would say is not someone of modest means. And so the capital gains tax cut must only benefit the wealthy. In fact, that's not the case because of this one-time nature of many assets that are sold to generate retirement income. And the color graph on page 35 and the numbers in the table above it, I think, tell the story in a different way. Roughly half of all capital gains are generated by people with incomes of below $75,000. And the bar graph, or cube graph, if you will, shows that as well. I think that what we're trying to present to you today is a story that Oregon is in need of an injection of some stimulus into its tax code to benefit the state of Oregon economically, its citizens. And this measure, I think, is an issue that we very much would like to see you consider this legislative session. As your staff has mentioned, we have asked for some amendments to be drafted, bearing in mind the budgetary implications of this legislative session, to move the effect of any revenue, negative revenue impact that you might determine is an appropriate estimate outside of the 2001-2003 biennium. And there are a couple of different approaches that are drafted in amendment form, one of which would take the rate down in two steps, that would be from 9 to 6 and then 9 to 4 over a two-year jump. And another series of reductions that would take over 3 biennial periods, the rate down to 7%, and then 6, and then 4. So it would feather out any revenue impacts that you conclude, with the help of your staff, are likely to occur to the state treasury. Thank you for your time. I'd be happy to try to answer any questions you might have.
Mr. Carlson?
Well, I guess I'd, I have kind of two lines of questions. One is I'm kind of confused about why, if capital gains is such an inhibition to the economy, that the economy's done so well with capital gains in place.
Well, the economy has done fairly well, and particularly in the late 90s in Oregon. I think that Oregon has been the beneficiary of some rather dramatic investments, starting with Intel's in the early 90s, and at least until recently, a planned additional major expansion. Oregon is now one of nine states estimated to be in recession already. I think even before that that conclusion or that finding was made, in recent months, Oregon was estimated to be the slowest growing state among the western states. And I think that the part of it is the heavy impact of taxation that we put in the state on income, but particularly capital gains and investment income.
And Mr. Chair, my other question is, I guess, same question that we asked Bill Sizemore when he was here, and that is, what do you intend to cut out of the current budget?
Mr. Chair and Senator Corcoran, thank you for that question. We have suggested a series of ideas for budget restructuring, budget changes, and I think that was distributed approximately a month or 6 weeks ago to all legislators, and we have introduced a couple of bills to follow through on those proposals. I think there are ideas both on the revenue side and on the efficiency side that we think are appropriate and necessary, and you know, none of these are easy decisions. You all certainly know that. But we feel very strongly that the state's public employee retirement system is in need of some rework, and I think that the Senate Business Committee is undertaking that issue right now, which I know you're active on, Senator Corcoran. We proposed some rather substantial change in 1995, ended up with a second tier in PERS, which is a fairly modest change. The cities and counties and special districts in 99, and I think again this session, are pleading for some relief from the costs of the PERS system.
Thank you for the PERS discussion. The fact of the matter is the suggestions you guys made about a month ago have been question, to say the least, and the issue about PERS is that even if the third tier was in the works, that doesn't have anything to do with the program cuts. We have to make this this coming biennium. I'm curious about the program cuts you would make, given that the revenue picture is the revenue picture, and given that we are working on a budget right now.
There's another bill, Mr. Chair and Senator Corcoran. It's actually scheduled for hearing this week, and it's a bill that we promoted in earlier legislative sessions as well. And that is a simple budgetary tool that if a position stays vacant for 6 months, that it reverts, and the dollars reverts to the fund from which it was appropriated. I recall that when Governor Roberts touted the need to restrain government spending, and she announced a cut of some 3,000 positions or whatever. In the end, there were no positions. There were no employees that actually lost their job. Vacant positions were cut. And it's a management tool that we think the state ought to have to better manage those budgets. That's just one other idea. The state motor pool is an idea that's been kicking around for a while. We've supported looking at that very carefully. It's not passed. Essentially selling the state motor pool, going with reimbursement to employees for use of their private vehicles and other ways, perhaps contracting out those transportation needs of the agencies. We have a very expensive correction system in the state. One of the highest in the country. I think perhaps there ought to be savings somewhere in that system. if we're that far out of adjustment, if you will, with typical costs across the country. Just some ideas that we've thrown out there on the table.
So you've cut public safety, Mr. Chair, is that your response?
I don't think cutting public safety is what we have in mind. Taking a look at how we're expending resources to house inmates in the correction system.
Thanks.
I was just chuckling, Mr. Carlson, because I was driving up this morning, I was reading the story up there. Apparently, there's a debate going on the House side now in terms of increasing doubling the level of supervision of work crews for a $4 million increase in budget because of people walking away.
Walk off.
None of these decisions are easy.
It used to be called escapes, now they're called walkaways.
Walkaways. That's a much kinder word. Senator Mintz.
Gary, could you go over again the objectives and the respective outcomes of the capital gains tax reduction? But I think I heard you say that eventually, because of, I assume, increased economic activity, that there would be a gain in terms of income taxes to the state. Is that correct or not?
I can't guarantee that, and Mr. Connerly certainly didn't guarantee that in his report on the subject, Senator Mintz. What he said was there's a range of estimates depending on your optimism or conservatism, if you want to use those terms, with regard to what a cut in the rate of capital gains taxes would do in terms of economic activity in the state, which then translates into tax revenues generated from that economic activity. It gives four ranges, the most optimistic of which is you won't lose a dime. You're going to make money off cutting the capital gains tax. And I think Mr. Connerly said something in the middle of these two ranges is probably the most likely scenario of economic growth generated by this reduction.
I mean, I'm looking at reading the business section of the Oregonian today. More companies announcing more layoffs and more projections of a stagnant economy and so on and so forth. And also, the Japanese economy is not doing well. Pacific Rim is not doing very well. I'm assuming that because of those economic factors, it would be less likely that we're going to achieve any net gain in business activity, economic activity, simply because there's no place to go. There's just the markets are slowed down, and it just doesn't look like anything's growing.
Well, Senator Mintz, I think that in the short run, that's certainly true. What you're talking about here are issues in the economy and in how taxes affect economic behavior that are longer term in nature. Yes, you do get the initial pop of revenue where assets have been locked in people's minds. They have not wanted to turn those assets because they're going to pay 29% out in taxes. The rate reduction that occurs results in an initial surge of sales where people say, well, now's the time to sell. My tax cost is down. Then that changes, obviously, after the first several months or perhaps a year, and you won't get that initial rapid growth, and you're gonna head toward whatever steady state is as a result of that change. And I think that's really what the dynamic revenue estimating model is supposed to do for you as policymakers.
I guess one kind of follow-up question. Would it be prudent to, if you were going to provide a cut in capital gains taxation, that be allowed where that money that's gained is turned back into, or I guess reinvested, I suppose, in a certain kind of investment, like a venture capital pool or some other kind of an instrument that would put money back into the economy to stimulate economic growth? And I'm thinking, and I'm by no means a tax expert, but I know the federal government did some changes to capital gains on real estate recently.
Mr. Chair, Senator Mintz, I think if I understood your comment, the question correctly, it was, can we try to target a change here in terms of reducing capital gains burden in such a way that we'll have a bigger bang for the buck for Oregon? I think it's very difficult to do that. What the federal government did, which was new and was last in 97, in addition to just reducing the general rate of capital gains, was to provide a new lower rate at 18% for certain kinds of investments and going forward, and only if you held them for 5 years. So that's a relatively unusual kind of a federal treatment of capital gains, because it's simply difficult to try to micromanage economic activity to that extent.
If I can just follow up on that for a second here, you in fact in Oregon did, and I believe it was in 94, try to target some of the reinvestment, capital gains reinvestment. We were a little over enamored with the key industries at that time. It made it very difficult, but I think they did have some mixed success in doing that, although there were a lot of problems with it, which I know Eric Brackwell, Altage and his group had commented on some changes. The other one is just lowering that capital gains is no assurance that you'll have higher investment necessarily. And if you look at our neighbors on either side of us, both economies to date are doing far better. And Washington State has much higher level of general business taxes than Oregon does, although they don't have a capital gains or a corporate or personal income tax. Their taxes are higher, and they seem to be doing pretty well, as well as California, which, as you pointed out, has a higher tax structure than we do, and I don't think they're having a particular problem. The other point is, over the last 2 years, we've seen significant increases in venture capital investments in Oregon, and I think that has more to do with the quality of the opportunities in state than it does with the tax treatment. I mean, frankly, I think we'd all agree that smart money follows smart ideas more than taxes.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that comment. And I've tried to get some people here who have a broad perspective and some history and knowledge and understanding about how economic activity is generated and promoted, and I think can speak to some of those issues that you raised.
Senator Castillo?
Yeah. I just wanted to say thanks for your testimony here today, and I appreciate this report. I think it has a lot of really good information in it, and a lot of, I think, a lot of issues that really do warrant some serious consideration and a serious look at tweaking what we're doing with capital gains today. I guess for me, you know, it comes down to, as we all know, those working on the budget are right now looking at every nook and cranny of state government for extra dollars, so we don't have to do some of these really painful cuts in our budget that we're looking at. And so I just take a look at, you know, what our staff has put together on the estimated general fund revenue impacts, and I realize this is done on the main bill and not on the bill, you know, based on the amendments that are offered. But if I understand that in conjunction maybe with some other things that we would do to our tax system, it makes sense to take a very serious look at tweaking what we're doing with capital gains. And it's my understanding that Representative Shetterly's bill that he's working on does address that somewhat. Is that right?
It does have an element dealing with capital gains.
Yeah.
Senator Castillo, that's true.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Thanks, Gary.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Mint.
I have a question about the fiscal impact that is projected here. Given the status of the stock market and where stocks are going, were there some assumptions about growth in those kind of investments and what the capital gain might be received over the next? In other words, I think we've got a market change where if there was an assumption that the market was growing at a certain percentage, but now we're seeing it tumble. There's not necessarily an actual loss of income, because we're going to lose that anyway, I'm assuming.
Senator Minnis, members of the committee, the capital gains assumptions underlying this revenue impact are those that are built into the March 2001 revenue forecast. I think it tracks at around $4 billion in capital gains realizations per tax year, which is it's quite a bit under what we've had in the 97, 98, 99 tax year period. One thing about your point about the stock market decline is that there's been a large sell-off. That's one reason why it's run down. And that may translate into considerable capital gains in this current tax year.
So we have kind of a tail again, I'm assuming, where you'd have a collection of capital gains because people are selling it off, and then I think that would be for a brief period of time, but if they held those, I don't know what in the heck I'm talking about here. I've got this picture in my mind, I just can't explain it.
Actually, we're doing pretty well.
Yeah. I'm just assuming that if, for instance, if the May forecast is down $100 or $200 million and it looks more dramatic in terms of reduction for the future, then that would change these projections.
Senator Minnis, members of the committee, that's correct. These estimates are very sensitive to the revenue forecast and the capital gains assumptions in those.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going back to the original presentation we had, and it seemed to me that there was a large portion of our income stream that was from capital gains, so we are fairly sensitive in that arena. Okay.
Thank you, Gary.
Mr. Chair.
We'll let some others talk for a while. Mr. Palmquist? Welcome.
Thank you. Haven't done this before. I'm just trying to figure out how to get started.
Okay, if you could just give us your name for the record so we can get it on the tape.
My name is Steve Palmquist. I'm an entrepreneur. I was the founder of Integrated Measurement Systems up in Beaverton. Since that, I've been a vice president at two other Portland area technology companies. When I talked to my family, told them I was going to come down here and talk about capital gains, I got this kind of blank look about, you know, taxes is boring and the legislative process is boring. And we got into, I hope not to put you to sleep. I'll just take a few minutes. But, you know, what I told them is the tax structure is the thing that determines a tremendous amount of behavior on the part of people in Oregon. And I believe from my own experience and that of many others that I've worked with that the capital gains tax structure in Oregon is resulting in fewer jobs and lower wages. And I think that's something that, whether it's an intentional impact or not, it certainly has a significant impact on our state. As you know, the Oregon's capital gains tax is the second highest in the U.S. and one of the highest in the world. And the results of this high tax is lower investment spending. You know, capital is the seed corn of business growth. And there's a lot of talk about, you know, what happens if we don't spend the money on capital. And in my business, a very close analogy would be an investment on engineering or R&D spending. When times are tough for a company, they say, let's cut that back. And successful companies rarely do, because that's the seed corn that develops the new products that allows the business to grow. And capital is the seed corn that allows Oregon to generate new companies and new jobs. I have provided jobs for thousands of people in Oregon, and those people all become taxpayers and have paid far in excess in taxes over what the total amount of venture capital and other investments that we had in the businesses that we've put together. Another result of the capital gains tax is lower wages. As you have high growth rates, wages increase. If you have a lower growth rates, wages do not increase. There's been some talk about venture capital funding here today. That's something I know a fair bit about. Clearly, capital gains does affect venture capital. The amount of venture capital investment is driven by what's going on in the stock market, because that's an alternative investment, and it's also driven by what the return is. Venture capital is a very high-risk business. About 1 out of 10 companies actually succeeds. About 2 out of 10 become what they call the living dead. They're trying to figure out how to get rid of them, but they can't, and the rest of them fail. And so the percentage of money that is taken away from the return clearly reduces the amount of venture capital that will be invested. The third effect of the capital gains tax in Oregon is that I see a number of entrepreneurs leaving the state. In fact, I have a friend who's a tax advisor, and when an entrepreneur comes to him, the first thing he tells them is to move across the river. They do have higher business taxes, but the overall net effect to the entrepreneur and to the organization is much more beneficial. And so you're seeing rather substantial growth across the river in Vancouver. I think the effects of lowering capital gains has been shown to benefit not only all income classes, but the government itself. A U.S. Treasury study showed that about half of the capital gains are paid by people with wages less than $50,000 a year. After the 1997 capital gains reduction from 28 to 20%, some of the results of that were an average worker's wage increase of about $250 a year, an additional 720,000 new jobs to the economy, and tax receipts to the government increasing in each of the following 3 years. There's also an increase in venture capital funding, which I think one of the questions earlier alluded to, you know, why are we having all this investment in Oregon if Oregon's capital rates are high? Well, there was a reduction at the national level, which helped and spurred a significant amount of that venture capital. In addition to venture capital, entrepreneurs, particularly those raising less than $500,000, typically get their money from individuals. A New Hampshire survey of 284 new companies found that taxable individuals were the major source of funds for people raising less than $500,000. In the Portland area, we call them angels, although if you've ever taken their money, you might have a slightly different impression. works both ways. You know, my feeling on this is that if you spur investment in Oregon by reducing the capital gains tax, and you start a new business, which brings in workers who didn't have a job before, who are then tax-paying citizens, you're going to get that tax money back. And it's the same principle that a business uses when they invest capital dollars in new equipment, which provides new jobs, when they invest capital dollars in R&D or engineering, which provides new products and new jobs. I believe it's time for Oregon to change the economic policies which discourage savings and discourage investment and stop penalizing economic growth. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer those, or otherwise I'll go back and report to my family.
That wasn't very painful at all. I'm curious, Mr. Palmquist, you've obviously been very successful, and I think you said you invested in starting up three businesses in Portland, right?
I invested in starting up one. I invested my efforts in growing two others.
From your experience with those businesses, can you tell me what kinds of decisions would have been made differently if we didn't have the capital gains structure that we do in Oregon?
Well, several things would have happened. How do you explain it? When you take money from a venture capital firm, there's a valuation they place on your company. And that valuation is in part due to what's going on in the stock market and in part due to their returns. And they calculate their returns expecting to make 10 times their money in 5 years, which sounds obscene to some people, but if you realize that 9 out of 10 of those companies aren't going anywhere, the average rate of return isn't that good. So the valuations would be better. The people working in the company would own a larger piece of the company, and it would be easier to get a venture capital. There would be more of it. I would have been able to grow my business faster.
From their perspective, and I'm assuming my observation is that most venture money in Oregon, at least up until the last couple of years, is primarily out of California or Seattle, to some extent out of Colorado. Now, from their perspective, when they're putting money in, they're putting in generally purchasing C stock, and when they sell the business, they're not going to pay Oregon's capital gains at all.
No.
So why would that affect them?
Because it may not affect them if they're not paying it, but clearly the amount of venture capital that was available when I started my company was exceedingly small, mm-hmm. and it's grown dramatically, largely as a result of the capital gains reduction at the federal level. It's made it much more attractive to put money into venture capital firms. That capital gains reduction has resulted in the starting of a number of new businesses in Oregon that otherwise wouldn't have. When I was trying to raise money, it was very, very difficult to find dollars.
Probably today, too.
Well, it depends on the deal. I mean, there's a lot of uncertainty in the economic environment, but, you know, again, that's also driven by the government policies. The reduction in capital gains rate, putting that money into Oregon, started those businesses and has provided jobs and additional tax revenues for people. The reduction in Oregon individual capital gains, I think, would substantially increase the angel activity and would benefit the smaller businesses that are trying to get started. If you want to raise venture capital and you go out and you're looking for $500,000, they don't want to touch you. These people have large funds. They can't afford to manage something that small. They want to place $1, $2, $3, $4, $5 million into something. The small business, something that's only going to grow up to be a $10 or $15 million and maybe employ 300 or 400 people, is largely funded by the angel community. And a reduction in capital gains there would step up that activity significantly.
What would you think about a policy that is very parochial, that said any investment made in an Oregon company and held for at least 5 years would be exempt completely from capital gains?
It's a no-brainer.
As a trade-off to a general capital gains?
Well, any capital gains tax is taking money away from growth. It's taking jobs away from people, it's driving down wages, and it's lowering the economic growth that Oregon can have. Anything that you do that reduces that, whether it's strictly related to Oregon or whether it's related across the board, is going to spur that activity. Clearly having a reduction for only investments in Oregon is better than doing nothing, but it will limit some of the investments that come in.
Senator Corkman?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Palmquist, how long do you think, I mean, to me this just sounds like trickle down all over again. How long do you think that the turnaround would take place if there was a capital gains reduction and you're saying that that money simply goes for growth and investment? I wonder if that's the case, but let's assume your scenario is correct. We're going to lose a lot of money. We're going to lose on the order of $1 billion, a little over $1 billion in the next 6 years with the capital gains cut. How long is it going to take the ship to right itself so that we see that coming in the form of other income tax, for instance?
I would expect you would see that within the first year. You know, it's like people would... If you reduce the capital gains, people don't take this money and put it in their living room and swim naked through it. I mean, it has to go somewhere, okay? It has to be, you just don't store it in the kitchen cupboard. Capital is invested. I mean, there is virtually, either that or it's spent and consumed. There's no storage of it. And whether you consume it or whether you invest it, it's clearly good for Oregon's economy. The reduction in capital gains, if it just stirred one person like me to go off and start a new business where my last one generated 300 jobs in Oregon, what are the tax receipts that you gain from the income taxes on those 300 people that wouldn't have been there otherwise? You're going to make a profit on this.
Well, Mr. Chair, the problem with that is that it sounds very unworldly. I mean, the reality is that, you know, if that were the case, if your scenario was correct, then there would be no revenue impact with the capital gains cut. In fact, we'd probably show an increase in revenue to the state. And I'm a little concerned when our revenue people look at this and say that, you know, we're looking at a $300 million hit in this biennium, and nobody has the answers, as you heard earlier, nobody has the answers about what they'd cut. The high-tech folks come in all the time to us saying, you've got to fund engineering, you've got to fund, you know, more adequate education in K-12. We've got to do a better job in higher education. This money all comes out of the general fund. It doesn't come out of, the naked people throwing the money back in the coffers. There is a loss here. I was just asking, if you think that the return is instantaneous, then this probably is a no-brainer. Just reduce the capital gains. But it appears to me that there's got to be some lag time for the creation of those jobs that you talk about.
If you announced today that beginning in January 1st of 2002 there would be no capital gains, or pick your favorite number somewhere along the lines there, the angel community in Portland is immediately going to say, I have more money to invest. And rather than waiting till January 1st, they would be starting to interview and do the due diligence and line up the companies. And yes, you would see an increase in activity. And the way you get your money back is through increased income taxes from the people that they employ. If what I'm saying doesn't work, no business in the nation could grow. A business grows by taking money and investing it in future opportunities, either through R&D or through the purchase of capital equipment or setting up manufacturing lines. If that didn't work, there would be no growth. We see that work every day. We saw that work with the 1997 capital gains cut. It's just the natural order of things. You know, growth generates tax receipts.
Mr. Palfus, thank you for coming down today. And a couple of things. You've got a lot of experience, obviously, in taking an idea and making it into a business and creating jobs. Where do you see the opportunities for Oregon in the future? And assuming that you had a capital gains tax reduction and there was additional venture capital available, where do you think those smart dollars are going to go in terms of our economy? I'm saying that because in the district I represent, we have LSI Corporation, it's kind of a major research facility mm-hmm. that they've been developing, although they're slowing down some of their growth. DuPont Photomask built a plant that's been vacant and basically mothballed for the last 2 years, waiting for the economy to turn around in the electronics industries. And Merrick's Corporation, building a manufacturing plant that they've just recently announced, they're slowing down because of the economy. So I'm kind of wondering, since we've transitioned from a timber-based economy to largely a technology-based economy, where do smart people like yourself and others see those opportunities? Because we get a little pessimistic here.
I can see that.
But we do, because we have that dilemma that we're trying to, and we're not certified smart economists, and we're not necessarily brilliant entrepreneurs. I'm a cop, and Tony... But we do need that kind of advice and counsel, kind of as an addendum to this. I don't know why this room is not filled with certified smart entrepreneurs and business people who are saying, look, you boneheads, this is where we need to go and here's why, because this is where the money's going. I mean, I see lobbyists, I see people that I see here every single day, but you're the only normal individual.
There might be a couple others
who I don't see every single day. In other words, if this is such a wonderful idea, and I tend to agree with you, but somehow somebody's got to convince me, and Tony, of course, that this is a good idea. It's a good investment.
Let me try.
Yeah, go for it.
First of all, I think I resent being called normal.
Sorry about that. I apologize.
You know, there's a lot of talk about losing money, I've been an executive of three different businesses, been through a lot of budget plans, budget cuts, and you get the same argument every time. You know, because people tend to look at things as a static situation. You know, if we make a change and everybody's behavior is the way it is today, then here's what's going to happen. But people's behavior is driven by what you guys do. Okay, your actions drive decisions that people make. And if you make Oregon a difficult place to grow a business, they simply go do it somewhere else. I mean, it's not like Oregon's going to fold up and go away because there are people who are going to live here no matter what. You know, I didn't leave Oregon when I started my company because I had four kids in school and they liked it here. When I start my next company, I will do it in Vancouver because this is a very unfavorable place to do it. And so Vancouver will get the 300 jobs. In terms of investments, I think the places that you're going to see dramatic growth, and this is something you should consider, what kind of economy you want. I don't think there's going to be a lot of money flowing into the timber business. The two areas that I think we're going to see probably tens, if not hundreds of billions of dollars invested over the next decade are going to be in the high-tech area and in the biotech area. The biotech revolution has just barely started. It's where the PC industry was, say, in 1972. They just figured out what's going on, and there's going to be substantial dollars flowing to that. With the Oregon Health Sciences, you know, Pill Hill down there and stuff, you would think that Oregon would be positioned dramatically to provide a rather substantial economic base in that area. And it's something that the state ought to actively pursue and go after and bring in those dollars. the high-tech revolution that everybody talks about, I also believe, is just gotten started, okay? Most people can't use a computer, you know, and those that can hardly use what's there. The issues that need to be resolved there is, going forward, the interface to the computer will be speech rather than keyboard, which is good because I'm not terribly coordinated. And that's going to allow virtually everybody to use one. And so there's a lot of investment that's going to be going into those areas. People have talked about the internet. It became kind of a cliche until we hit the dot-bomb environment. The problem with the dot-bombs is, you know, they had business models. They didn't have businesses. And people have figured that out. But it doesn't negate what's going on there. I think we're still going to see tremendous investment in that area. And so if you lower the capital gains rate, what you're likely to see is an increase in biotech and technology in Oregon. I don't think it's going to do much for timber or those other areas.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate you coming down. Hope it wasn't painful. It's always good to hear different insights than we do every day.
The other good thing about going to Vancouver now is you've already had your earthquake up there, so it'll be very comforting. You'll have to wait another 400 years.
Well, it was in Seattle.
Olympia. See, AGC folks. Dee and Larry. Welcome.
Thank you. Maybe we're some of those normal people here, too. My name is Larry Sitz, and I'm vice president of Emmerich Construction Company in Portland and a member of the board of directors of the Associated General Contractors. I don't think we're one of the leader industries in the state of Oregon, the construction industry, but we are a support industry, and we're highly affected by changes in the economy that occur. And it's real volatile to us. And a big part of our industry, Gary talked about kind of at the close of business sort of decisions where capital gains affected businesses when you're getting ready to retire or sell. In the construction industry, particularly those that are equipment heavy, road building, paving, that sort of stuff, where there is a lot of capital investment involved in doing the business, the capital gains tax is a huge disincentive to them, and particularly in a falling economy, because what's happened in Oregon, where it's been growing so well, people have equipped to match the capacity with the need of new construction. They're now at a position where they own iron in a market whose capacity is going down, and so they own too much iron. And they're in a position where they're having to sell that iron, have to pay capital gains for selling it, and so that's causing a hurt to them. Similarly, they have to make decisions about productivity in terms of buying new equipment to replace old equipment because the new equipment can do things better. Those are sound decisions that they should be making, but the capital gains tax is a disincentive to those kind of decisions. It essentially puts an equation in there that says, we have to pay capital gains to increase productivity the next time we want to sell this piece of equipment or trade it out for the next most productive. So with the tax in place, what we're likely to end up with is rusting iron sitting, waiting for the next growth period where that iron can go back to work. And that's not what should be happening. It should be cash in the pockets of the people so they can invest it someplace else. With the tax in place, some of those decisions are borderline, and it's more logical to have the iron sit, and it doesn't increase the economy in the state of Oregon. So we're strongly in favor of a reduction of capital gains or elimination entirely.
Hi, my name is Dee Birch, and I'm president of Advanced American Diving, a general contractor based in Oregon City. Senator Beyer, members of the committee, we're certainly, and Senator Minnis, we are some of the normal people. We're definitely not lobbyists. You probably figured that out by now. One of the things that I wanted to just make a point about was succession and passing businesses down. As a small business owner, I've been through a couple of cycles in our own company of people coming and going. And as a small business, you know, the biggest problem you have is to be successful in the first place. And once you get past that, you figure out real rapidly that the next thing you have to figure out is who's going to take your place. Because these businesses generate a tremendous amount of jobs and a lot of growth in the state, but they don't run by themselves. They typically run with just a handful of key people. And if you can't find those people and figure out a way to look down the road and make an opportunity for them to own the business, you have a real retention problem and you have a problem maintaining the business. And most of us care a lot about our employees and want to see the business continue. And when we have something that's successful, we want to pass it down. And so the capital gains is a real disincentive and makes it very difficult. We've gone through and done models, and assuming that things go well, there's about a 10-year period for somebody who's a pretty successful person and working very hard to be able to own a portion of a small business that's successful. And if there's a health problem or, you know, someone leaves, these businesses can fall real rapidly. In Oregon, we have operations in Oregon. We also have operations in Washington. I'm a native Oregonian and an Oregon State graduate, and so really not a rational decision to be in Oregon. I think Senator Beyer mentioned people don't just come strictly by numbers, and a lot of us don't. You know, we love Oregon. We want to be here. But when you sit down and you look strictly at the numbers, it's not rational. We really should be in Vancouver. And a lot of the things you heard are true, and we are definitely in a down cycle right now as far as our own company and the people that we're talking to. We see things fairly early on where things start to turn down. And it's hard to find a contractor right now that it will tell you that they're having a solid year. Almost all of them will tell you that things are slower now, things are tougher, and these capital gain rates and considering reductions are something that would be well worth your time and something we'd really urge you to consider.
Mr. Chair, I can name one contractor, the guy that gave me a painting bid 2 weeks ago. Definitely was very busy. He didn't want to paint that house for that price. And there was another guy starving, and he took the job. The question that I would have is sort of harking back to what I asked Mr. Carlson, and that is, again, the small businesses in Oregon. Oregon is one of the leaders in the country in terms of small businesses per capita, and we've had the largest period of economic growth in peacetime economic growth, I think, in history, or pretty close, maybe the second most. So, and that's with capital gains. So, you know, where's the disincentive, and why is everybody going to Vancouver?
You know, I'm not an economist, and I mean, I'm just a contractor, so I can't really get into the big scheme of things. But just from my own experience, it's hard to find somebody who hasn't done well. And in my own opinion, it's in spite of the capital gains. It really is not related. There's so many issues that revolve around it and so many things that interact, and it's such a dynamic situation that I don't think you can make, and that's just my own opinion. I'm not speaking for AGC. I don't think that you can make that. But I can tell you that as good as things have been, it sure doesn't look very good right now.
Or how much better it might have been had it not existed. And maybe Oregon wouldn't be one of the 9 declared recession states now.
Well, that's, Mr. Chair, that's a good retrospective view, but I'm sort of getting at the point of we've already got, you know, figures that show that corporations in Oregon are, you know, we're a very low tax state. We're down next to Mississippi, like 44th in the nation or something. So, and we have a, you know, a crisis that has quieted this building down, the quietest it's been at least in the 8 years I've been here, and other people have been here a lot longer than that. And a lot of the attribution of that quietness of this building is the cuts that we're contemplating in programs. And so, you know, I'm left sort of with this question of, you know, good economic policy or not, and I just can't buy the notion that if we declared the capital gains tomorrow, that the next day there'd be no revenue impact. I'm just left with, you know, why in a time of increasing need would we be granting this kind of tax cut for the higher end folks?
I'm a lifetime Oregonian and a Republican, but I don't argue that we have to have money to run our state government, and that our state government needs to invest, particularly in infrastructure sort of things, and that we have to be able to pay for it. I do argue that capital gains should be a component of that funding source. And I would have been an advocate and have been an advocate for sales tax for a long time, but it isn't going to sell in Oregon. So, I mean, it's a problem, but I don't know that not changing capital gains is going to affect that. I think it will help. We may have to replace the funding some other way.
I guess I'd add that there's probably no better time to look at it than starting into a down cycle. Trying to look down the road and trying to project ahead to being proactive and doing something positive that's going to help Oregon stand out in the region, there's probably no better time. And there are a lot of difficult choices, and I don't think we pretend to have the answers to those, but this one is one that would have positive results.
Thank you both. We have a few more people, and we're running short on time. Don Schellenberg and Don, boy, you're going to help me with the last name, aren't you? Sersovsky?
There's some Sersovskys around Junction City, too. Joe Sersovsky. Oh, great. These kids are great athletes. Going to Marist.
The Marist Connection.
Marist Connection, that's right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Don Schellenberg, representing the Oregon Farm Bureau. Just right up front to say that Farm Bureau supports Senate Bill 67. Also, the Oregon Cattlemen's Association, Oregon Wheat Growers League, the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association, and the Oregon Seed Council are also supporters and given me their permission to make that statement to you today. With me today to talk about the importance of the special capital gains tax rate is Farm Bureau member Don Sersovsky. Mr. Sersovsky is an agriculture producer and a member of Oregon Farm Bureau's Tax Advisory Committee. And pleased to have him here today to make some comments. And when he's through, I'll make a few more comments. Thank you.
Well, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to come and speak in favor of Senate Bill 67, the reduction of capital gains rate. I am Don Sersovsky, Vice President of the Linn County Farm Bureau Federation. I'm a grass seed grower in Junction City and Harrisburg. I farm with my brother Joe. Our Farm Bureau policy states that we support a capital gains rule that would exclude 50% of nominal gains after adjustment for inflation on assets held more than 3 years. Your current bill does not address this policy directly, but due to current farm circumstances, any relief from taxation is welcome and very much appreciated. If I may, I would like to address the issue in the area of capital gains as it relates to land sales and its effect on farming. You must be especially aware that here in the Willamette Valley, agriculture has been devastated by many uncontrollable situations. We have lost a very large number of row crop vegetable acres due to the bankruptcy of the Agripac Cannery Company. Chiquita Canning, who took over one aspect of AgriPac, is leaving Eugene this season. The agribiotech bankruptcy has put many grass seed growers in a very harsh financial situation. In order to survive, it is very likely that some of these growers may have to sell portions of their farms in order to pay off some of their financial commitments. A reduction of the capital gains rates will go a long way in reducing the amount of property they will have to liquidate to survive financially. In most cases, when a farmer sells a piece of farm property, he does so in order to purchase another one closer to his base of operations or one that will make its operation more profitable. In these cases, the capital gains tax is often reduced or eliminated by the rules for replacing lime in a timely manner with land of greater or equal value. In the case of these farmers with cash flow problems relating to the above-mentioned bankruptcies, the purpose is not to acquire more land, but to reduce the debt load they are already carrying. There will be no other properties purchased in order to reduce the tax consequences. Even the slightest bit of tax relief allowed will help them. I offer you this quick example. Let's suppose a farmer is now farming 1,200 acres. It's a grass seed farm. With the grass seed market in the current slump it is, he loses $150,000 in the ABT bankruptcy. I know farmers who have lost that much. He decides to sell 80 acres of his property in order to maintain his farm. He thinks he can survive if he controls and keeps that other 1,120. I suppose these acres were bought in 1971. He paid approximately $500 per acre for it. In order to recover his losses from the ABT bankruptcy, he sells them at the current rate, which is about $2,500. That's $200,000. He paid $40,000 for it. He will get $200,000 for it. Current law does not take into any consideration adjustment for inflation, so the net gain is $160,000. At a 9% rate, the tax amounts to $14,400, whereas a 4% rate would be $6,400, a net savings of $8,000. Now, these numbers may not seem very large to you, but they could very well make the difference between the ability to save that farm or having to liquidate completely. I was at a meeting several years ago, and there were 11 farmers in the group. It was run by the American Farm Bureau. And the representative of American Farm Bureau says, you know, this is the right group of people in this room. He said, there are 11 of you here. 10 years from now, one of you will be left. That's where the farm economy is going right now. So for this reason, I appreciate your efforts in pursuing this bill. Please do pass it out of committee with a due pass recommendation. Mr. Chairman, again, thank you for allowing you to speak to the committee on such a timely and important issue.
Mr. Sirsofsky, the example you gave, I'm just unsure of the economics of this. You take a $150,000 hit with the bankruptcy of ABT, and you take a $160,000 capital gain on the, and I don't know much about taxes, but you take a $160,000 capital gain. Can't that help? Can't you use the loss to offset the capital gain?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Carkin, yes. But you have to realize, too, when you cut back that 80 acres that you're not going to be farming, that is a significant percentage of your income for future years. And you still have to go to the bank next year with a budget that shows a 15% margin in it, or they won't loan you the money to operate the next year.
Mm-hmm.
So the operation, then if you can't get the operating money, the only option is liquidation.
And I guess I'm just trying to be clear about the effect on farming that this would have. It would seem to me that in the example you gave, that absent the $150,000 bankruptcy problem, if you had the $160,000 gain, you'd be paying capital gains on it. And the assumption would be made that you'd be farming that much less farmland the next time. But
right. And when you add the tax in there, you do come up with a negative number.
Mm-hmm.
Small negative number, but again, it's just one little chip down the line.
Right. I think, Mr. Chair, I mean, just an observation that, you know, the damage done by, you know, federal trade policy and the other sort of market conditions of production and so forth are really hammering the farmers big time. There's just no question at all whether it's the mint farmers and their competition or whether it's what the Canadians are doing in the, you know, with the wheat and timber. I mean, those are kind of cyclical conditions. I was trying to figure out this notion of you know, when the capital gains is assessed and trying to weigh that against the bankruptcies, because those bankruptcies are a killer too, I'm sure.
Mr. Chairman, Don Schoenberg, again, the Oregon Farm Bureau. Along that, you know, that same line, agriculture producers, they put their capital back in their operation, necessarily so, and they forego a lot of things to do that, and one of the things that most common they forego is any other kind of investment for retirement. They've put all their money into their operation, and that's pretty much what they depend on to carry them through retirement. When you retire and you sell your farm, you have a capital gains, and you're taking money out of their retirement with the current, well, with any kind of capital gains tax rate, for that matter. But the lower the capital gains tax rate, the less onerous that would be. I would want to make a couple other comments where this also has an application for dairy animals and beef breeding stock. These are other assets that do appreciate if you buy them young, raise them up, and then sell them when they're done with production. You have a capital gain there that you also have to account for. And so this has an application there as well. Another reason that we would support the bill is the consistency issue. I go back to the time when I was farming full-time in the late 60s, and we did our own income tax, our own federal income tax, our own state income tax. And there was a point in time, and some of you probably recall, where we had on depreciation schedules. The federal had one set of depreciation criteria and schedules, and here at the state we had another one. We finally worked our way through that one. This federal government has a capital gains tax rate. You have to identify what is your capital, which assets qualify for capital gain tax rate. And you do that anyway, it only makes sense that in Oregon we would also have a capital gains tax rate that we could apply to that income that we've identified as being subject to capital gain. So we, again, would appreciate, and I would simply say that, again, all the organizations that I mentioned, the natural resource organizations, would urge your support for Senate Bill 67. There are amendments, and, you know, we're supportive of whatever we can do to get this thing on the road. It's important for the agriculture producers. Thank you.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
For questions for staff.
You have a question?
For staff. What's the tax treatment for gains that occur within PERS? And is there any tax payable on capital gains from PERS investments?
Senator Minnis, members of the committee, taxes or income accruing to retirement plans generally is taxed as ordinary income at the time it's withdrawn, whether it's capital gains, whether it's interest, whether it's some other kinds of transactions within the...
So some states like Washington, Nevada, Texas do not tax retirement income. So when that money's drawn out, if you're living in the state of Washington, then you pay no personal income tax on it. Right. There is no capital gain in terms of the gains that are received through the investment of those monies in the various investment instruments, whether it's stock or bonds or whatever. It's just as ordinary income. So you can literally avoid any tax at all by moving to a state that doesn't tax personal income.
Senator Minnis, members of the committee, I believe some states have some requirements on origin of the income with, if you're working in a state at the time. And
she can add enough.
Accruing deferred income. Oh, let's have someone who knows what they're talking about.
Mr. Chairman, I just raise this because, I mean, on one hand, you've got people working in agriculture and private industry who are maybe depending on the gain in their assets and the sale of their assets at retirement. Mm-hmm. For the purpose of sustaining their life, they're paying a capital gain, whereas individuals who might, like myself, work in public employment, you know, those investments are in essence protected.
Mm-hmm. Short answer. Sure. I'm going to get the other two people we
Sure.
have.
Fire, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. Ed is correct that prior to 1996, states could use pensions earned in a state and then tax those even though the person left the state. That's no longer the case. And only the state of residence can tax the pension at this time.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, just one question. So there is no escape of the for the farmer who sells off all of his assets to go into retirement. Then that all that sale would be considered as capital gains or as income, and we'd be taxed on the whole. Amount, or do they have some ability to roll it into a retirement plan like other people do and not have the same tax consequences?
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, the short answer is taxes would be paid. There may be an ordinary income component for depreciation recapture. There may be a capital gain component. There are opportunities to do rollovers, but generally that's into like-kind property, which would be other business property, which could then generate income. For example, a person could take a farm and put that into other types of real estate that could generate income, and that could be non-taxable. But if they simply sell, then generally taxes will be due.
Thanks. Mr. Blackledge. Sorry to get you at the tail end, Eric.
Senator Beyer, members of the committee. My name is Eric Blackledge, owner of Blackledge Furniture in Corvallis. I'm one of those real people also. I'd like to support the passage of Senate Bill 67 and the amendments to it, which would phase in the fiscal impact of the bill, from two perspectives. First, I support the bill from a small business perspective. As chairman of the Oregon Governor's Small Business Council and the Northwest Region's Tax Issues Chair for the U.S. Small Business Administration's Office of Advocacy, I support the bill because high capital gains taxes, and Oregon has, as you heard, the second highest capital gains tax rate in the United States, have a significant negative impact on small business people. Salaried Oregon employers, as you were just discussing, receive many tax-sheltered incentives to save for their retirement through 401k plans and the public retirement system, all of which are recognized by Oregon's income tax code. Small business people often, out of necessity, have to invest their retirement funds in their own business. This is true both of business people and also of people in the agricultural community. They have to invest them in their small businesses, which are then, and then the benefits of those as they get a gain are then taxed at the high capital gains rates in the year that they sell them. And unfortunately, as opposed to retirement programs, which allow you to gradually receive the benefits of the money that you put into a retirement program such that you stay in a low income tax bracket. In most cases, with a capital gain, it all comes in 1 year, and so it is normally taxed at a much higher rate than would be true of a long-term retirement program. Capital gains taxes are also particularly inequitable because a significant percentage of the taxable gain is often just inflation. If I buy a property as a way to save for my retirement now that costs $100,000, which would now pay for perhaps 50 months of long-term living expenses, and it inflates over a period of 15 or 20 years to $200,000 in value, or at least in theoretical value, it will still only pay for 50 months of inflated living expenses if the expense of the inflation rate of other things grows at the same rate. And after paying a 9% capital gains tax, it won't even pay for those 50 months of retirement living, so that actually there's a decline in the value of the investment over that period of time. I also support the bill from an economic development perspective. As the past chair of the Tax and Public Policy Committee of the Oregon Emerging Business Initiative, now called the New Economy Coalition, and a member of the Governor Kitzhaber's last tax system policy advisory group, I support the bill because Oregon's high capital gains taxes reduce the availability of capital for investment in new businesses and also reduce the management expertise that's available for new business development. Small businesses are the heart of Oregon's economy and account for over 97% of Oregon businesses with employees and over 60% of total jobs in the state of Oregon. When faced with a high capital gains tax, successful entrepreneurs who have built a business and are ready to sell it are actually given an incentive by the state of Oregon to move outside of the state before they receive that capital gain so that it will not be taxed at Oregon's high capital gains rates. They move to states such as Washington or Florida that have no state income tax, or many of the other states that have lesser income taxes. Sometimes they also relocate a successful business in anticipation of that rapid value growth, as we heard in earlier testimony. Many of these successful business people later start new businesses or provide mentoring and investment capital to other startup businesses, but they do so then in their new home states, not in the state of Oregon. This is a major long-term loss to the Oregon economy. Most individuals with substantial capital gains also have other taxable income, probably pay far more in taxes than they use in state services. These people are the these are the kinds of citizens that really we want to be attracting to the state of Oregon, and yet we have a tax policy which drives them away. And state tax policy does have a major impact on the kinds of investments that occur within that state. If you look at it from the standpoint of a business, and I know you're dealing with that issue of how do we pay for state services, you have to look also at what tax policy does to the kinds of people you attract to the state, and whether you're primarily attracting people who are paying more than their fair share in terms of taxes and therefore contributing to those public services, or whether by having a tax policy which discourages those people from living in the state of Oregon and pushes them into other states where they find a more attractive tax picture, and instead you are attracting people who have a higher cost, who are paying less perhaps in taxes every year than the expenses of the state of Oregon to support the services for them. That becomes a long-term issue for the state in terms of how you're going to meet that budget. In 1986, when the federal tax code was revised to replace the 60% exclusion with a lower federal tax rate, Oregon's tax rates on capital gains effectively doubled. Congress later further reduced the federal rate on capital gains to encourage savings, investment, and economic growth because they realized federally it was important to the health of the economy, and I think the benefits that it's had, if you look at what's happened in the economy over the last few years, have certainly proved that case. I know that the current economic forecasts are not strong, and I know that you're facing a crisis in terms of the budget this year and an issue of how you're going to allocate money for many of the programs that we're used to having in the state. But I think it's also important that you look at that long-term tax policy issue and the implications of the decisions you make in terms of tax policy on what the future economy of the state of Oregon is going to be like. I think it's time to follow the federal model and to return fairness and balance to Oregon's tax on capital gains by returning to the historic 4% rate that was true prior to that 1986 tax change at the federal level. I'd also like to answer quickly a couple of questions that have been raised earlier. Senator Minnis had raised the question of targeted tax relief. And Oregon does have a number of programs, as does the federal government, for targeted tax relief for small business. We found, unfortunately, in doing research on those for the last legislative session, that many of those programs are underutilized and have not had the economic impact, which you'll see if you take a look at the tax revenue report, the tax cost report. They simply just have not been used. I would certainly not encourage you to take them off the books, but some kind of broader relief for capital gains is really necessary. Senator Beyer had also raised the question of out-of-state capital investment, and that is true. There has been a significant amount of out-of-state capital investment, and that has certainly benefited Oregon businesses and helped finance much of our business growth. But in many cases, obviously, those people who live out-of-state, if they're investing in a business, as was raised, and it's a C corporation, they're not paying any capital gains taxes in Oregon anyway. So we're actually more attractive to outside investors than we are to internal investors. And yet the logic for most angel investors is the closer to home you invest and the more you can get involved in your investment, the better the long-term potential success for both you and the company. And Senator Corcoran had also raised the question of we have had significant growth in the last few years, and so therefore, what's the issue? Why are we having those high capital gains, have we had this kind of significant growth? And a lot of the answer is a question of timing. Exactly because of that economic growth, there's a great deal of built-up potential capital gains. People still have the option of moving to Clark County in Washington and completely escaping from that capital gain. So the short-term impact is not as significant as the long-term tax policy impact, because those people will move out of state. If they start another business, they'll start that in another state, and they will make their investments in another state. They will deposit their money in banks in another state. All of those things will have a benefit for some other state with lower capital gains taxes and not for the state of Oregon. And lastly, just in terms of that broad tax policy issue, I think it's just important that you keep in mind that if we're going to have adequate revenues to support state services in the future, we've got to have a population base of people who are making the kinds of incomes and the kinds of capital gains that will more than pay for their fair share of expenses. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Well, Mr. Chair, just an observation. Hearing the small businesses and the agricultural folks would make me interested in a, you know, some sort of something along the line of a homestead exemption, except an income or capital gains exemption for people at the time of retirement. You know, I can see the, it's clearly, with, especially the farm situation or a person selling their business to retire, that I can see that benefit. I'm not convinced of the rest of it, obviously, but there is clearly a different treatment, you know, with retirement income available to salaried folks versus small businesses, and I think that would bear some looking at.
Thank you, Eric.
Thank you.
Steve?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Steve Lanning, and I'm with the Oregon AFL-CIO. Our president, Tim Nesbitt, couldn't be here this morning, but he did provide written testimony, and I'm just going to quickly go over it. We strongly oppose Senate Bill 67 for the following three reasons. Reducing the capital gains tax rate will provide a disproportionate benefit to high-income taxpayers and highly profitable corporations. Resultant revenue losses will compound the state's general fund budget shortfalls now and in the future, and working families who will gain little tax relief from this proposal are likely to bear the brunt of cuts in services, since the state's general fund is a primary source of funds for education and health care services. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your time.
Thank you, Steve. Questions? Thank you very much. JL?
Thank you, Chair Byer, members of the committee. I'm JL Wilson, representing NFIB. And Eric did a good job of stealing my thunder, but I wanted to illustrate the capital gains issue with a personal story. You know, KAJO AM 1270 was started in 1957 by my grandfather, who moved out west from Oklahoma and decided to set shop in Grants Pass. And 43 years later, and hundreds of thousands, maybe even close to $1 million later, when we've invested in a second radio station, bought land and buildings, radio towers, transmitters, translators, recording equipment, satellite dishes, sound and control boards, CD decks, the whole list of what goes into a radio station. We did all this because when there was any question of where the Wilson household income would go, it was all reinvested back into the business, which brings to bear my point that small business people accrue their assets through their business. It's a story that's played out tens of thousands of times right here in the state of Oregon. And it's because the family business is the family retirement plan. And like I mentioned, this story is replicated throughout the state. We've had several offers on the radio station in the past couple of years. And the difference between locating this business in rural Oregon and locating the business in rural Washington amounts to several hundred thousand dollars. Now, nobody can accuse our family of being cash rich, but do we have some assets? You bet. We've accumulated them through 45 years of investment, sacrifice, and some work. And that's the story of family business in Oregon. You know, and I think there's an awareness of this that's starting to gel in this state, and I'm not saying that we should cut the capital gains rate down to zero or slash it in half this biennium, but I am saying it does discourage what I think we want to encourage, which is entrepreneurship, risk-taking, and some asset accumulation, especially with how we compare to other states. So that is my testimony. NFIB obviously supports Senate Bill 67.
Thank you, Jan. Any questions? Is there anybody else who would like to address Senate Bill 67? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 67, and there being no further business, we will adjourn until tomorrow.